Welcome back to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Sundress. Today, Ben Templesmith is here to talk about his new Image series with Ben McCool called Choker. We'll also discuss Ben's forays into the digital market. Plus, we look back at some past projects like Groom Lake with Chris Ryle, Hatter M with Frank Bedore, Fell with Warren Ellis, Hellspawn and 30 Days of Night with Steve Niles, and Ben's own series Wormwood. We talk about Ben's approach to art and the subtle differences he brings to each project, and take a look back at the last 10 years of Ben's career. This episode of Word Balloon is brought to you by C2E2, the Chicago Comics and Entertainment Expo, coming to downtown Chicago this April. Word Balloon is also brought to you by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com, where Ben Templesmith is well represented with lots of product, from the hardcover of Ben's first Wormwood story arc, The Gentleman Corpse. The standard retail price is $24.99, but at InStock Trades, it's just $17.49, or the Groom Lake trade paperback at InStock Trades, just $13.99. Plus, our friends at InStock Trades have a spring convention coming May 22nd in Fort Wayne, Indiana, the Summit City Convention. We'll talk about that later in the show, but for now, check out the great deals on trades, hardcover collections, and more at InStockTrades.com. Are you coming to C2E2?
I am apparently a guest of honor.
Outstanding.
So, I am definitely a guest anyway. They're getting me out there, so...
Will there be a big push? I mean, obviously, Choker came out this week as we're recording.
Actually, it didn't technically.
Tell me about that. Okay, because Chicago got our copies.
I can give you a story, and you can disseminate some information.
Please.
All right, Choker was originally solicited and was going to come out on the 10th of February, which it is now. Then, for some reason, we were told it was going to be pushed back to the 24th as a release date, which was pertinent because we're doing a few things to do with the launch. So, fair enough. Then we only recently see that, well, it's sounding like it's coming out now, like the initial date. And we're like, okay, So I talked to Image again, see if there's any way they can push it back potentially to the later date. I'm like, yeah, we'll look, but I don't find out too much until more recently. In the meantime, they got copies of the Choker was printed.
Okay.
And apparently the printer didn't get the mix of ink and water correct or something on the copies. So when Image saw this, they said, no good, you're going to have to redo this. This is shit, because a lot of the copies are apparently wavy and odd.
Interesting.
In a misprint way. So Diamond, although they've had a lot of shit to deal with lately, actually had to pulp the run, and the printer's reprinting it. That's not a problem. But it was going to push the release date back a week anyway, so they're just going to push it back to 2 weeks to make it the right date for all of our events. But some of the retailers actually did get copies and haven't destroyed them, even though they're apparently told to destroy them and not ship them out officially. Like, I don't care, but as long as people get good-looking comics in the end. But
certainly.
That is why there are some copies out now, but officially it's not meant to be out, and it will be out on the 24th.
Okay, well, then we'll treat it still as a preview. You were kind enough to...
you do what you want. Do what you want, man.
Well, no, we can inform people who were maybe expecting it on the 10th, too, what's going on with this interview, so that's great.
Yep, it should be out officially on the 24th.
Okay, very cool.
But there are copies now floating around there, just inferior copies.
Yeah, okay, well, that's good. And, you know, hey, man, that can bite you in the ass. I remember Joe Maduro with the first issue of Ultimates. I mean, that was really a concern, so I can appreciate, you wanting the people to get the right look for the book and everything.
Well, I'm guessing most people don't expect their comics to be all weird and wrinkly, so that wasn't intentional. It's not a special... Because it was the water sort of like made the paper go a bit weird, apparently.
So it's not a printing problem. It literally is a paper problem of having kind of puckered paper.
Oh, yeah. It's not some weird misprint. I mean, technically, the book could still be a collector's item in some weird way. But apparently, yeah, the paper's a bit wrinkled and stuff. I've heard from a few people that said their copies would be odd. They're not complaining about it, though. That's the weird thing. They're just saying, maybe it's because it's me. I don't know.
Well, as you say, maybe this is a way to make some money on eBay first before...
Yeah, so technically, they should actually be having replacement copies coming. So
okay.
Yeah, those copies were not intended to be the copy. So
very cool. All right, I understand now. Well, again, the PDF you sent me, man, it looks beautiful. And it looks like... It looks like you're doing something different with your faces compared to some of the stuff I've seen from you in the last couple of years. Would you say that your sketching is a little different for this series?
Couldn't really tell. I don't know. Maybe I'm just trying to improve my drawing. And let's face it, there's a lot of improvement to be made. So, yeah, maybe it's just that. I'm trying to put the work in. I'm adding a bit more detail and the occasional background, which apparently I get accused of not doing too many.
But I think that's an interesting style, and let's talk about that for a second, because tell me about the decision, when it came to you, to kind of have this impressionistic background to behind these sketches that you end up finishing more in paint and everything, and just your style. When did that come to you as a way to go?
Well, my overall style is what it is, so I'm not the overly rendered cross-hatching type guy. So my job is to tell a story as efficiently as possible, as clearly as possible. Maybe I failed a bit there, but the general reader is only going to look at each panel and glance and then move on to the rest of the story. So I'm not going to sit there and, as a commercial person making a decision, I'm not going to sit there and spend 2 hours rendering the windows in a background skyscraper when I could do some sort of trick where I've taken reference pictures and I can sort of Photoshop bits of that in, or I can do impressionistic, very sort of quick, giving you the information but not overly rendering it way of doing things. So it's an efficiency thing. It's as much a style thing. I mean, I don't like drawing boring things, so I'll concentrate on, I don't know. I mean, I had this discussion with a couple of people the other day, in that a lot of comic book people, when they're actually drawing, like superhero comics are a genre unto themselves, they're more destined to lend themselves to the widescreen and to the cinema.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas my work, kind of, and a lot of the stuff I deal with, is more suited for more like TV. So it's more character-oriented. There's a lot of people just talking heads and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess my style adapts to that, in that I'm not drawing Lord of the Rings here, you know what I mean? Or Spider-Man with a huge sort of dynamic reference points and views and
panoramic
cityscapes.
Yeah, cityscapes or panoramic shots in the case of Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, the very nature of the work has to lend itself to what, you know, you have to draw to what the work is lending itself to. So, I don't know. I hope that explains it some. I'm not a complete slacker, but there's efficiencies and there is logic to it.
There's like an ethereal feel of the way you use light. You and seem to really be a friend to using white to this kind of glowing effect, and I think that's something that is different than what you might see on television. It's almost anti-noir.
Yeah, there is a bit of that too. I think I am a bit obsessed with mood more than detail.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't give a crap sort of about the bricks in a building in the background so much as what is the mood of the image I'm trying to convey for the storytelling purposes. So I would add, though, actually, I forgot to mention, it's like, not only do I pencil and then ink and then do, like, ink washes and watercolory type tones on it and then add white highlights just on the original art before I scan it. I mean, I do all of that. I don't just do a straight pen and ink thing and then have another guy color it. So it's all me.
Right.
So I can do that, whereas most artists can't do that. Although a lot of artists I'm noticing now do a bit more sort of grayscale rendering into some of their line work, like Simone Biace and I think J.H. Williams and a few other people
certainly
into that now as well. So it's a great effect, but I do more work than some artists. So when they say I'm slack, it's like that really like annoys me, because like, well, most people don't do this stuff. So yes, mood is a big thing for me,
and
it goes to the light. So.
Well, where did your ideas and inspirations for this kind of shading and coloring really come from? Who did you learn from?
Actually, I only discovered it a few years ago now, where I actually probably got most of my color theory, or the way I see and want to do colors from, which is, you will never have heard of him, but he's a guy named Victor Ambrose. You've probably seen his work in some form at some point, because he's a book illustrator. Lives in England. He's actually from Hungary. He escaped during the communist era.
Wow.
And he's an old guy now. He's illustrated over 200 children's storybooks and referencey type books where you draw nice illustrations and things. And so I grew up with his art, but I didn't realize until later who his name was, and revisited some of my old favorite books, which visually, you know, influenced me. Like, I actually have a color scheme and do things in a similar way to him in many ways. And I'm love his art. Anyway, English people would probably know him best as the guy that does artistic renderings of... There's a TV show, it's like a reality show called Time Team, where you literally go to some people's backyard and dig it up in an archaeological sense. And he actually does, like, what this place would look like back in Roman times. So he's a well-known artist in England for that now.
But, wow.
Yeah, he's pretty much unknown for most things, but he's an artistic genius, and he's probably one of my biggest influences. But I couldn't have told you that a few years ago, because I only had to rediscover where I had my actual roots from, why I do things. But apart from that, Ashley Wood, Dave McKean, Ralph Steadman, Sam Keith, a bunch of people like that.
And, you know, it reminds me of kind of a 50s and 60s American style that I think, a lot of paperbacks would use. It reminds me of some of the more lurid kind of crime paperbacks.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And again, maybe
I don't know, hopefully this isn't just, oh, and you saw the PDF, not the print job, so I'm just going to say, I hope it wasn't that bad a print job that everything was overly saturated, but, yeah.
No, I see a difference in this compared to, and as you say, and even reading some articles to prepare for this, there is obviously a linkage to all of your books from a style sense, but this does look different from, say, Fell or Hatter M, and it has its own more modern, and I think, again, in more of the sketching and more of the characterization rather than the backgrounds.
I do try to be slightly different for each project. I mean, if it needs it. So, yeah. No, hopefully this one I was trying to go for more the horribly bright neon and I don't know, just like amp things up a little bit rather than darken things up a little bit. So.
A heavy metal kind of feel almost as well? I mean, this looks like
a bit.
I was going to say, it looks like it could like fit in heavy metal.
Yeah, I guess a little bit. It's meant to be sort of like apparently a Chicago from the 30s, although I wasn't there to get proper reference, but... but fused with a futuristic city, so you've got a lot of visually bright and dynamic and weird things, but then, yeah, I wasn't trying to make it like Blade Runner. Oh, no, actually, well, I don't know. Blade Runner was pretty bright in places with the signs and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. We'll see how the rest of the issues go, because it's going to get, the tone may change and the storyline will take it where it takes it. So.
For people who haven't read the first issue, how would you describe Choker?
I have been known in the past to describe Choker as Fell with a bad case of gonorrhea. it's essentially about see, Ben McCool is the best guy to explain it. I think he was saying it was like he wants it to be like a Raymond Chandler comic on crack or something, but or with a bit of Hunter S. Thompson gonzo type stuff thrown in. But,
I like that. That's very good. I like that a lot.
Yeah, well, see, he's right. That's why he's the writer on this and not me. But, it's meant to have elements of the private eye and redemption of getting back on the police force. It's got a very detective element to it. For anyone that was a fan of Fell or a fan of, like, the kind of black humor and quirky dialogue as well, they'll definitely be fans of something like this, I would say, to be honest.
I always like that infusion of two different genres together, and much like I enjoy the sci-fi western, I think the sci-fi detective noir kind of feel is fun to play with and gives an opportunity to give homages to things like you say, Chicago in the 30s, but then also go your own route in terms of a futuristic look as well.
Exactly, but when you fuse two things like a detective thing, detective noir and a futuristic sort of setting thing, it opens up opportunities to even play with the story. In the 30s, they weren't having crimes where you could, graft DNA onto someone else or something like that. It's like, so there's storylines that can open up simply because you're dealing with more science fiction, I guess, which is good.
Absolutely. No, this looks cool, and as you say, I think fans of Fell will find it good comfort food to come back to this style of your art. And,
and by the way, just to talk about Fell, I don't know if anyone saw on Twitter the other day, but Warren has sent me new Fell pages.
Oh, that's great.
Not an entire issue's worth, so I'm not holding my breath, but he has promised he's going to get me more, so...
Wow, that's great, man. Well, I know for years, people would see you or Ellis and ask about Fell, and, oh, it's coming eventually. And it's like, well, that's great because clearly Fell was one of those great comics, I think, from the first decade of this century. And I think you guys definitely put a book out there that a lot of people still talk about. And I think the trade is probably still doing quite well, I would guess.
Yeah, the trade actually sold out. It had a really big print run, but it literally sold out not too long ago, so they're actually having to now go back to print.
Well, congratulations. That's great.
Well, thank you. It's mostly Warren's fault. It was an honor to work with him, and it still is.
Well, that's very cool, man.
It's Warren Ellis. He has his way.
Do you think... I'm sorry, say that again.
I said he has his way, and then I said with me, but then I had to add not sexually. As much as I'd like that, but not yet.
I understand. Have you guys discussed, should it come back, would it go back to that original 16-page, kind of $2...
I think the intention is to just... his actual... I'm not sure how public it was, but he was definitely planning to do at least 16 issues. So he's probably got to finish... I mean, he's going to finish it the way he had the rest of them done, so... I'm assuming it's going to be, the same format and everything, and
And I lost count. Were we at 9? Were we at 11? I forget where we were.
We were at 9.
Okay, that's what I thought. Okay.
He did one trade and then plus one. So there should, at the end, be enough for two trade paperbacks.
Fantastic. Wow, the $2 books are coming back. I understand the Fabio and Gabriel are back working with Matt Fraction on New Casanova as well. So there we go.
Cool. I mean, Matt's profile is much more different now than when he started, really. So he's huge now.
Well, you guys have come a long way, I think. I mean, certainly Warren had established himself, but, I think...
Yeah, but Warren Ellis was already Warren Ellis, so... But at the same time, hopefully the model can be really good for someone like Matt now. So, I don't know. I think you really have to sort of be a bit more established first before you take that on, just because the lower price point means you have to sell a lot more to make it probably more sustainable, I guess, so... And those guys have gone on to huge success since, so it'd be great for them to come back. So.
Sure. But I would imagine...
I look at the business side of it as much as anything, like just be able to eat, obviously, when you do the work. So.
Do you see yourself maybe tailoring Fell to be a digital product now as well, in terms of what you might be doing with it?
Yes and no. It's actually something I have been thinking about, but that's something I have to talk about with Warren about where he wants or what he wants to, where he wants to digitally put it. I'm sure he's had offers already, but I'm getting more and more into the digital side of things myself. But the nature of Fell is that it's a 9-panel grid, so I guess it's relatively easy on the whole to adapt it to, like, the iPhone or the PSP.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of IDW books are at right now. But, and the iPad, the sanitary product that is the new thing, is, that's going to be a whole new kettle, another kettle of fish. So just the page dimensions are a little bit different, but... Hopefully you can fit most of a page up.
Yeah, I got to be honest. After the unveiling, I was a little underwhelmed in terms of what it might do for comics, and I wonder what your thoughts were when you first saw it unveiled.
Well, it's going to be the Kindle one, because it's color in that sense. But it's the dimensions are slightly not right for comics, I guess. But it really depends on, for me... as a device, I'm not going to buy it straight away at all. But it's going to have to reach some sort of critical level before it's going to be useful really for comics, because I don't think everyone who reads comics is suddenly going to go out and buy one. But the iPhone's already in the built market with millions of people using it, so but what was my point? My point was because they launched the thing called the iBook, which hopefully, because right now everything's just put in iTunes, but iTunes will be iTunes and then iBook will handle all the print media and stuff, so hopefully that's where comics can come into their own and become a bit of a, an easy, the newsstand of the future, so to speak, because mm-hmm. newsstands went away and stopped comics being so accessible to the masses for a lot of people. So, I don't know. I see interesting... It's going to go that way eventually. It's just a question of how long it's going to take and how many people can take advantage of it when it does and before it does and give for the future.
What else are you looking at digitally as you see how your art will adapt to this new platform, not just with the iProducts, but really, everything that they're throwing out there right now?
Oh, you mean to do with the actual appliances?
Well, yeah, not so much the platforms, but are motion comics something you're considering and toying with or anything?
Oh,
I stepped on a landmine.
No. I have very strong opinions on motion comics in a sense that if a comic moves and if it doesn't have word balloons, it has voiceover. It is no longer a comic. It is at least a cheap 1960s cartoon. Right? It is. It's not a comic. A comic is words and pictures.
Right.
words and pictures.
I agree.
Voiceover on an image, which I've done, and I've been involved in some of those. Fair enough. When Dead Space comic I did was actually adapted to be sort of like that.
Okay.
To me, that's not a comic. I mean, I didn't sign off on that. That was just done as part of. I had done the comic, and then they decided to adapt it as a thing. And a million people saw that, so that's great for me. But I wouldn't consider that a comic. A comic has to have words and pictures.
I understand.
And once you add bells and whistles to it, it becomes something else. I'm fine with that, but that's not comics for me. But I'm kind of being involved in, hopefully, in some stuff moving towards that direction, just because it makes things a bit more accessible and adds a bit more interest to particular projects. But I wouldn't be in favor of adapting existing things. I'd rather do something new meant for that format so you can actually play to its strengths more than just sort of, you know, paying lip service and trying to adapt something that already exists.
I understand, and I think to what Bendis and Maleev did for the Spider-Woman thing, because it was made to be this motion, you know, animated kind of comic, but also to be, you know, made into a traditional comic book as well. And Maleev drives me crazy. He won't do interviews. He's always self-conscious about his accent. But it's something that I know.
He's got a great accent.
I know.
I spent like 5 hours in a car with that guy when I was in the UK. Like, no, he's nice. He's got a good accent.
I'm with you, man, and believe me, I've tried to convince him, but I think to the point of annoyance now, where I finally like gave up trying because he is, and that's okay. I mean, it's his own self consciousness.
Tell him you can use one of those like witness protection or like voiceover things when someone doesn't want to be identified, so his voice will sound weird anyway.
I first met Brian Bendis.
Yeah, like and you can black his face out if there was a visual, and it's like he's like a fugitive or something.
Ooh, that's a good idea. I'll try that next convention. I will ask him about that.
A whole reputation about this thing.
But yeah, that he was, you know, making the he was making all the images simultaneously, or at least thinking. He said, at least from Bendis's point of view, that it was a concern to make both mediums work with the art and everything.
So the Spider-Man thing didn't have word balloons then, did it? It had a voiceover?
It did, but I mean, there are subtle differences to the comic book and the motion comic.
You run into problems. If this is the big thing that irked me, kind of irked me as a creator, trying to do one thing but then didn't know it was going to be adapted to another, is if you have a word-heavy panel, you have to draw small or whatever, people are in the background. But then when it's a voiceover, well, you don't have the big word balloon hindering the panel, so you could draw it with much more detail and much bigger and, you know, make it count as a keyframe. They didn't do that in my adaption, but knowing that, Alex probably has made things look a bit different, so hopefully, but still fitting in the dialogue, hopefully.
It's kind of like writers going into computer games as much as, you know, or even television and film, you know, as opposed to writing comics as well. I mean, it's a chance to stretch your artistic, you know, muscles in a different medium.
Oh, yeah, and there's pacing issues and various, you know, format issues that they'd have to deal with just because of the nature of the, you know, the length of time they've got to play with, I guess. So, yeah.
Let's talk about Groom Lake, because happened to notice on Twitter as we were talking that I saw Chris Ryan.
It's a worrying precedence. I say something on Twitter and you apparently just call me up and get me to quote, you know, get the real story. I don't know.
You and Chris Ryle just did an audio commentary for a couple of the issues that are available on PSP?
Yes, we did. I think it's the second or third actual audio commentary on comics on the PSP. I actually did the first one on PSP, which was Wormwood Gentleman Corpse, which then went on to be... And I'm going to spruik this one first, because I wrote that as well.
Sure.
But it was number one for 3 weeks, and it's basically in the top 10 in like three or four places, I think, for the to date. So
that's great.
Really well on PSP. But it was actually the first one that pioneered the audio process, which my lady actually came up with. Because she works at IDW as well, and so she organises the whole audio side of things. So, and then the second one I've done, I think there has been some more, and she's certainly organising some more with Joe Hill and whatnot on Lock and Key and such. But, the second one I've done is Groom Lake. And it was quite extensive with Chris Ryle, because we had a big, long chat, because with two people it's always better than one.
I think that's terrific, and I'm very curious to hear... you know, I don't have a PSP. Now, do you need... I mean, really, is that the only platform that these things will play on, or will they play on netbooks or anything?
Well, it's a Sony thing, so I think they're going to be expanding to, like, the PS3 eventually, but it's still technically a Sony PlayStation-y type thing. So,
sure.
But the audio is actually to give people a sense if they don't know what the hell I'm on about. But if you own any sort of PSP or PS3, you'll eventually know. But it's like a director's DVD cut commentary type thing. It's where the creators talk about what they were doing for various panels or for the comic overall and such, and it just, you have a little option to use it whenever you come up to a certain panel. So it's really just fleshes out the comic and adds a little extra. It's not like a voiceover of the voice characters or anything like that. So.
No, I understand. And so then it focuses
Some people didn't.
Oh, I see. Well, it focuses then on specific panels, or do you guys do a general overview of the book as well? And
well, you can do whatever you want, because I think the trigger is certain panels. So, I mean, the tech people have to, like, set it for whichever bit of dialogue goes with whatever panel, but then the dialogue can go for as long as you want, and it can be about the specific panel, or it can be about anything. It's up to you guys, or up to me. So, yeah, it just, I don't know, it enhances the comic, and it's good to get into people's brains as they actually read a comic, and you can tell them all sorts of stories and research about what was going on in the comic, but not in the comic. I really don't know. Or just have fun and joke about penis size, things like that. We actually did that, so yeah, the commentary's a little rude.
So were they a bunch of individual sessions for each panel, or did you guys just kind of have a free-flowing conversation?
It's a one long interview thing, but
it'll be chopped up panel by panel.
Yeah, but we pick and choose which bits we're going to talk about each time we keep talking in the conversation. So, I mean, then it's cut up and inserted however they do it. So,
very cool.
No, it's just an added little extra, but without detracting from the actual comic. So it's not like it's a motion comic or there's, you know, character voices or anything like that, which I'm not saying they're bad, but they're different. This just literally keeps the comic as is, but adds a narrative, a sort of a...
Absolutely, comic. And it's, I mean, let's be honest, this is one of the reasons why I think DVDs grew as quickly as they did, is because they had enhanced features like this. So I think it makes perfect sense. And as you say, it's something that doesn't detract from the original material, as we were talking about before, that a motion comic really does change when you lose the dialogue bubbles and it stops being text and pictures and it's fully dramatized audio. But in this case, yeah, it's examining the work for what it is.
Yeah, and I have to actually say, besides... the Sony team that are putting this whole thing together, because the comics on PSP is actually really pretty new. They're a small team in the UK. I actually went and visited them and chatted to them. They're actually big fans of Wormwood and a few other smaller titles.
Fantastic.
Rather than just the big stuff. Yeah, so they're really lending support to independent sort of comic books, but also just comics in general. And they've been working, IDW has been working with them since they were thinking about even doing comics, so we've really been on the ground floor, and part of that was IDW's suggestion to do the audio as an option, just to even, so they included it in their code and whatnot, so that we could actually do it. So, yeah,
that's really cool. So compare that to what you did for Wormwood. Then Wormwood, were you doing that solo?
With the actual talking, yeah. That was just me trying to come up with crap, which was easier first, and got harder as I did, you know, the second and third volume.
Well, that's cool.
Yeah, I'll do more.
There will be more. That's fantastic, man. This is the way that digital should be used, is to add something beyond, you know, what you're getting from the comic book. I think this is the way to promote something digitally and make it more special.
I agree. I was thinking another thing that you could do, but obviously rights are a pain in the ass, and people can add their own music, but some sort of, like, theme, atmospheric, set-the-mood music for an overall comic. I mean, it probably wouldn't work that easily because, you know, one mood for a whole comic isn't going to work usually. Because comics have, you know, scenes. Some are big and some are small and quiet, blah, blah, blah. But, I don't know. Someone should do something creative like that.
If companies are willing to spend the money. I mean, the Watchmen motion comic, they really did get a full score composed for...
It was also surrounding a major motion picture release, though. So not every comic can actually have the finances to I guess, do most of that stuff, unfortunately. But who knows in the future, you know?
Yeah, and it is interesting, though, that there are more composers that really are out there with a synthesizer, the way that television scores are done. And, you know, I mean, I agree, you know, yeah, that's something that's out of the ballpark. But, you know, man, I just see a lot of content providers out there finding a price, and maybe some composers as well that are looking for some sort of exposure will find a price, and maybe that'll happen. You know, I mean, if they can do it for audiobooks, and I've certainly heard it on some audiobooks, I see no difference.
I did not know that. So there you go. People are already thinking about it.
You know, well, this is going back to, you know, cassettes of audiobooks. I remember the Star Trek books. You know, it was all just incidental synthesizer music here and there. But, you know,
it
provided a mood, and I think it was kind of interesting. So you never know, man. And technology has made that kind of production, music production, that much easier, too.
It's an interesting new world, but we'll see, you know, who and what take advantage of it, really.
As you say, Wormwood is doing really well on the PSPs. I don't want you to get into specific numbers, but is there,
I don't know specific numbers, so I can't help you there anyway.
Oh, okay, because I was just wondering, how well are comics doing on PSP, as far as you know?
From my impression is, I mean, it's still relatively small. We're not talking millions of sales or anything like that, but Wormwood itself was, I think the general price on the comics on PSP is usually about $1.99 right now on the US store, because it's a UK store as well. But I'm trying to champion the fact that at least the smaller independent titles that no one knows anything about should just be 99 cents, which seems like a fair price for me. So, and Wormwood's been doing really well on that. It was one of the initially released books when IDW put their first bunch up. But it was in their second wave. But, and they've got Transformers and G.I. Joe and all the classics up there as well, at least for the American market. So, I don't know, they've been going well. It's been a few months, probably a few months now that comics have been up there. Can't give you an address because I don't know the actual web address for it, but search for PSP Comics, you'll find it.
Absolutely.
And, hopefully they're going well, and Sony will continue to support comics as a thing to flog on Sony stuff. On the PSP.
Very cool, man.
Any new avenue to get people to look at comics, especially people who've never read comics much before, but it makes it easy for them to even try, this is a good thing. So, PSP, if you have one, check it out. And if not, buy one. I don't know. But it's all good and healthy for the comic industry, hopefully, as we transition to some sort of online market.
Let's take a moment from the interview and give me a chance to tell you a little bit about C2E2, the Chicago Comic and Entertainment Expo, coming April 16th through the 18th to downtown Chicago. The first time in over two decades that a national comics and entertainment convention has come to downtown Chicago. Join thousands of comic book fans, creators, and celebrities for a weekend of fun and excitement in the Windy City. Special guests for this year's show include Alex Ross, Jeff Smith, Jeff Johns, Mike Mignola, Ethan Van Sciver, Ben Templesmith, and hundreds more of your favorite creators. Tickets are only $25 for a one-day pass and $50 for the entire weekend. For a full list of guests, events, and how to purchase tickets, make sure you visit c2e2.com. But wait, there's more. If you go to c2e2.com/wordballoon, we're going to give you a chance to win tickets and exclusive C2E2 merchandise before the big weekend. We're giving away one amazing VIP package, three weekend passes, five exclusive C2E2 posters signed by creator and guest of honor Alex Ross, and 15 limited edition C2E2 t-shirts. Entering the contest is easy. Just go to c2e2.com/wordballoon and enter your name and email. That's all it takes. We'll be drawing winners from all the entries on March 19th. And that VIP grand prize includes a weekend pass and also lunch with a Marvel editor. It's going to be really nice. So you'll want to enter. Once again, it's c2e2.com/wordballoon. And all you have to do to enter is put in your name and email address. Again, we'll be drawing winners on March 19th. Stay tuned for more exciting news about the official C2E2 after-party plans, including our farewell to our friends at Around Comics. Plus, more ways to win tickets and exclusive merchandise. You can follow C2E2 on Twitter. Back to Choker. Let me ask about Ben McCool. How did you guys get together?
I was going to have some sort of attempted humor where I was going to say he's actually a love child from a previous relationship.
There you go.
But we're actually almost the same age. He's a little bit younger than me. But we met at Comic-Con 2007.
Okay.
And we hit it off because he likes a drink. And he had a foreign accent in America. He always grammar. As an Australian, I'm always going to find the non-American accents are quite refreshing because I normally only deal with American accents. So I'm always going to have to know where someone's from or whatnot. But, we met him at a little pre-convention party thing I've thrown a couple of times. And we just hit it off. And then he had a little incident later on at the con with Darwin Cook's head when there was... An event that he was innocent, and Ben McCool just got caught in the way of something and had his teeth half knocked out. So we caught up again just at after the convention, and we lamented his teeth, and they're still not completely fixed. But we hit it off, and I made a promise, like, no, we should do something together at some point. So within the year, we figured out what it would be, and now it's finally coming true.
That's very cool. Darwin hit him?
No, Darwin, the back of Darwin's head hit him.
Oh, I see.
Darwin's completely blameless there. I'm not trying to say anything that wasn't already actually publicly known mostly anyway.
Okay, I missed that story. All right.
No dirty secrets or anything. Yeah, it was to do with something else. But, Ben's teeth got the worst of that, I think.
Oh, that's too bad.
By accident. It was all an accident.
I see. Well, now you mentioned obviously you came from Australia and just really located here recently. Have you reached your green card status yet?
It's slightly more technical, but hopefully not too boring. I lived here for on and off for about a year a few years ago when I was meeting my lady, and then we moved both to Australia. I lived in Australia for quite a while. I moved back here more recently, I think in 2007. But I had a specific work visa for that to do with being exclusive with IDW. But I'm now out of that, and I'm literally just applying, and I'm halfway through the process to get a normal green card.
Very cool.
Which is pretty easy and going pretty well. So.
I happen to notice on your blog you said that you had a chance of doing something on film for TV or movies. I'm not sure which, but unfortunately at the last minute it would have required you leaving the country technically. And
I was asked to play myself in a major TV ad for a product from a major corporation, and that would have been great, except there was 2 weeks' notice, and it was going to be filmed in Eastern Europe, because that's cheap for a lot of companies to do that. But I can't leave the country until my paperwork's finished and finalized. So I had to say no. It sucks for me.
Yeah, I'm sorry to hear that, man. That's too bad. Jesus.
And it's amazing that they even asked me, so...
Well, I wanted to look back at a couple of things that you've done in the past, and one in particular was Hatter M, the miniseries from the Looking Glass Wars. And how were you chosen for that project?
I got an email out of the blue from Frank, really. This was before Frank Bedore was, before he was hugely into comics because we worked out a lot of teething problems with that book in how a writer-artist sort of can work efficiently and mm-hmm. ultimately get it done. So he is a complete consummate comics book writer now, and he's definitely writing more and going on well. But I think I got him when he was just starting out in getting to the comics, and he just emailed me out of the blue. I don't know how he found me or why he found me. I'm sure he's like ruining the day he heard of me, but no, it went really well. And I get all my jobs just because of random emails from people, really. I don't know how they find me. You'd have to ask them. My reputation precedes me, I guess.
But you kind of grooved him into how to, write comics more properly and everything. And
only in the sense that, how do I put it? He was giving me, huge paragraph panel descriptions, except they weren't panel descriptions.
Mm-hmm.
This is very early on in the piece. He fixed this quickly. But, I didn't need to know exactly what was running through his mind in great detail. I needed to know what the guy was actually doing in that panel. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's like it was the difference between prose and writing a comic script was basically it. So he adapted to that pretty quick. So that was what I meant. So does that make sense?
It does, and it leads me to ask, in general, because I just had Ethan Van Sciver on, and he was just talking about how he's wondering if the writer-artist partnership is as 50-50 as, it can be, comparing it back to the speculation days of the 90s, when it was much more about artists, and then the last 10 years, where writers have seemed to kind of take the lead again as far as where stories go. It would seem that coming to an artist like you, and your style, that it would have to be 50-50 in a lot of ways. I mean, just your style is so distinct and does a lot to define the work.
Well, it all depends on how a writer and an artist work together, and there's various different ways. Some are more hands-on, some are more hands-off. So I'd say it would really depend on which artist and writer you were talking about. But in my view, as obviously an artist first, I'd say artists do a lot more work than writers. I mean, because the artist not only gives the visual look to a book, but he actually actively has to tell the story, and he has to do that visually the best way possible.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of artists that don't know how to tell a story visually, and I'm not going to hold out my hand, but maybe that's me. You can accuse me of that if you want. But there are some that do and some that don't. Some writers by actually know how to visually construct a page and explain that to an artist of what they want. Some don't. So sometimes, you know, you can, if you got an artist that didn't know how to tell a story and paired them with a writer that didn't visually know how to, you know, get a sense of a page as much as writing what the story is, then you're going to get a bad comic. But if you get one that, you know, any other combination, you're probably going to get a half-decent one to play to each other's strengths. But I get to do it all myself, so hopefully I'm okay. But we're in the age of the idea, so, and the writer is definitely the guy that has the initial idea, apart from any execution of that idea. So writers are always going to hold the power like that, and fair enough. You know, we're in the information age now. It's not the industrial age, apparently.
Sure.
I don't see writers losing their power anytime soon and artists taking over again. I think that was just, I don't know why that was, but I wasn't there for it, and I am really disappointed that I wasn't.
Yeah. I understand from a dollar standpoint, I can appreciate that.
Oh, I hear stories from the guys that were in the tail end of that, and like, not even a million selling comic, but, just 50,000 for like, for a comic today that would sell, what, 9,000 copies maybe?
Certainly.
50,000 just at the beginning. Yeah.
Crazy. Well, you seem to be comfortable writing and art and drawing with things like Wormwood. What was it that prepared you to tell the whole story, both dialogue and drawing it?
Well, I'd always been doing that. The only thing was I'd actually only just broke in as an artist. So, and I, you know, once you're into the actual professional level sort of trying to do things. Professional level, me, I know what you're thinking. But it's another kettle of fish to try and write at the same time as draw. So I wanted to really get my bearings and get some experience behind me before I even attempted that. So I'm definitely an artist first. That comes easiest. But I was always writing and drawing my own stories long before I broke into comics. So I always saw myself as both. But I would never write for anyone. Well, so far, and I don't envisage, I don't see myself doing it, but of actually writing for someone else to draw. So I still prefer doing it all myself. So I think it's much more efficient once you can, you know, bang the work out. But because, you know, we don't have mental telepathy yet. A writer has to still explain to an artist what to do. But if I can do it all myself, I don't need to. So.
And I suppose that's true. It, you know, when you're first coming up with your ideas to draw and everything, you are writing and you are creating.
Oh yeah, I write in a very organic way. So I'm not doing it the way a normal writer would for an artist. I'm doing it. I do it in a purely sort of stream of conscious conversational way where I get the dialogue out once I've just figured out the major plot points. But then I lay it out on a page visually, and then I make the dialogue fit. Well, I make that fit the dialogue I've got, but I don't like give any panel descriptions or anything like that. So it happens much more organically than having a full script of any kind.
Have any of the writers that you've collaborated with, have they changed how you would approach writing when you were to do something all on your own?
You have been reading some previous interviews, haven't you?
No, honestly, if you...
Okay. Well, I figured I've said it a few times now, but... and this is not to say that it's a stupid question. It's an absolutely awesome question, because I like talking about this and pointing this out, in that after I worked with Warren for a while, Warren Ellis... I saw some of his unfinished scripts because he was sending them to me, like, literally as he was doing it page by page. Mm-hmm. He had half pages where he, to explain how he does it, how he did it. It seems like the dialogue is definitely the key and comes first, but then he was chopping it up into which panels it would come into later, and I saw that and ran with that as a way to write some sort of decent dialogue and to really get a rhythm going in any proper way. So, yeah, dialogue definitely comes first for me once you've got the overall structure, and then you worry about panels and which comes, you know, the bells and whistles. So I definitely took how to write from Warren than anything else. Maybe not in content, but in form, in how he actually went about it. So yes, Warren Ellis is, to answer your question.
Okay. Time to take a moment to talk about a great convention coming up, put on by our friends at InStockTrades.com and DCBService.com. The Summit City Comic Con. It's coming May 22nd, a one-day show, $10 for admission, an intimate artist-focused show, and hosted at the Grand Wayne Center in downtown Fort Wayne. It's a beautiful convention house, and it's going to be a great convention. The guest list includes Art Balthazar, Mike Norton,
Matt Kent, Tim Seeley, Robert Atkins, Nate Powell, Steve Bryant, Chris Burnham, Jim Rugg, Ryan Stegman, Katie Cook, Dave Wachter, and many more. Plus, there'll be publisher presence and involvement from Dark Horse, Boom, and Top Shelf. It's going to be a great day, and we hope to see you there. Word Balloon's going to be there. I know a bunch of other podcasters will as well. The Summit City Comic Con in Fort Wayne, Indiana. The one-day show is May 22nd, and it's only $10. It's going to be a great time. I hope to see you there at the Grand Wayne Center in downtown Fort Wayne, May 22nd.
Let me ask about the work on 30 Days of Night, which I believe was the first thing I read of yours.
That was almost the first comic I did. I did Hellspawn. For Todd, first.
And you know
where we met.
Well, actually, in thinking about it, I did read Hellspawn back in the day, and maybe I wasn't aware of who was drawing it at the time. But yeah, was it you and then sometimes Ashley Wood?
It was Ash to begin with, and then he went off and did his own thing. And the first book he left it with four pages left to go. So I came on to do those four pages, and I deliberately tried to make it look a bit more like him because I hate, you know, breaks in continually like him.
Sure.
So fair enough, people thought I was probably Ash at that point. But then after that, it was all me. Although the next issue after that, just to further confuse you, that first issue that I did four pages had my cover, and then the next issue had Ash's cover, but was all me. So yeah, who cares? It was one of us, right?
Well, when what number of Hellspawn was this when this was happening?
I think it was issue 9, 10, or 11. I couldn't tell you which one.
So that was when we were almost going to get Miracle Man in Hellspawn, correct?
Oh, yeah, that was just after that when they put – is it Mike Moran, that character?
Yes.
Ash had been drawing that in the book.
Okay.
I came on just after that, so I think I drew like him in a couple of panels, and that was it.
Okay.
And I was not privy to anything to know about any of that, and I'd actually literally never read Miracle Man at the time. I had no knowledge of anything to do with any rights or anything. So, yeah, no Miracle Man for me.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, was that after Bendis's time, or did you work with Brian at all on Hellspawn?
That was after Bendis had already left, yeah.
Okay.
But, Niles was working with Ash on the book before. That's where we met. But, they were definitely doing a few issues before I came on. So, yeah.
And obviously that's what, prompted...
You're bringing it all back to me. This is old. And I'm like, yeah, no, that was a vibrant time. A lot of things happened back then.
Well, this is the first chance we've had to have the long conversation, so we get the secret origin of Ben Templesmith, which really is only a secret to me. So this is my chance to find out about these things.
Oh, yeah, I don't mean they were big for me. I mean, it's like, Brian Bendis became Brian Bendis after he left for Hellspawn, and the Miracle Man thing, well, that's kind of still ongoing. But, yeah, no, I was around kind of that time, and that sort of happened. So.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, we're in 2010, and you can't help but look back, and... That's why a lot of really interesting things happened in the 2000s, the early 2000s, and that you were either around or certainly in the case of 30 Days of Night. I mean, that, again, there's another big milestone book that everyone can look at from the last 10 years and say, yes, that was significant. So, let's...
If you want to go further, you could also say that Todd has an eye for quality, if I wanted to talk myself up in any way. But, Bendis was on the book, and then I was an Ash... Ash is obviously Ash, and he's a huge talent anyway.
Yeah.
And then there's Niles, and then there's me, and we've all gone on to do things and have some sort of vague name recognition, although Bendis is probably the king of that. But, I don't know. Yeah. But, went on to big things.
You're right. It is interesting, all the different people that worked on Hellspawn, certainly, and even, I always thought Case File Sam and Twitch was always an interesting book, too.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Alex Maleev on Case File.
There you go.
On Sam and Twitch, yeah. That's where I found his work, and in love with it. So, yeah.
Very cool. Well, let's talk about 30 Days then. So coming off of Hellspawn, that's when, is that when, because did Criminal Macabre?
I never get asked about 30 Days,
I'm sorry?
I never get asked about that book, that little obscure book.
Yeah, I know, but no one wants to talk about that.
That was sarcasm, by the way.
Of course.
Sarcasm. Yeah.
Give me the origin. I mean, did it just kind of come from you guys working on Hellspawn that Steve's like, hey, I've got another idea, or how was it approached?
To preempt you there, because I've told this answer many times, but not recently, actually, but we were getting, relatively slow approvals at that point on Hellspawn, so we had a bunch of free time. It's like, well, let's do a pitch up, and I actually, my recollection is, and you'll probably hear differently from a whole bunch of people, but my recollection is I was given a list of pitch names and concepts, by Steve, and I happened to think that the 30 days one seemed pretty interesting. So I said, let's do that one. And I did up a few pages, sample pages, and he went out with it, because I was in Australia at the time, you know, literally working out of my bedroom, and he worked his magic, and eventually it landed at IDW, and after a few knockbacks from other publishers, and the rest was history from that point on. So, well, not really, actually, because the first issue sold really crappily, and so IDW weren't going to... Couldn't afford to... They actually asked me, it's like, Ben, first issue sold 3,000 copies. We can't really afford to pay you for the other two, but if you want to finish them, we'll still print the book. And just after they did that, it sort of the movie stuff sort of hit. So I was working on the book, and then it blew up. And then it got collected into the trade and sold pretty damn well. And
you bet.
Pretty much ever since. That was just me dropping a pen. And they did actually pay me in full at the end, by the way. So there was a happy ending to the story, but I'd like to think that me sticking it out on the book, even though I knew that it wasn't going to do too well, but I was still happy just to be in print at that point, so it didn't matter to me at all.
Well, very cool. And then the thrill of it being adapted into a successful film. How was that?
I mean, well, the film itself was successful, so even though, you know, it wasn't Twilight.
Well, I...
David's gone on to do Twilight now, so...
But did it do well enough that we might see more sequels, or...?
Well, apparently there's a direct-to-DVD sequel going on right now, so I'm out of that, but more by choice, because to me the first film is the... We're in Alaska and it's night, and like that's the one creatively that I signed on for and that I had a vision for, so I just don't really, you know... I don't feel invested in any way in any sort of taking it all to the LA scene and doing anything like that. To me, that's not the real core concept of what the 30 Days of Night was. So, but yeah, apparently there is some sort of smaller sequel going on now. There could be more if that one's very successful. So, yeah. I went to the movie set a bunch of times and you know, saw met the director, and he, you know, became friends with him and met all the actors and saw the set, and it was a great experience. But I kind of give credit to the actual hype to do with the movie option, which is what put me on the map.
Mm-hmm.
The movie itself happened like 5 years later.
True.
So I was happy at that point whether or not it got made, because it was so that was all like icing on the cake, or frosting on the cake, as you might say. But actually, just interestingly, I'm actually going to Barrow, Alaska, on my birthday in March, just for the hell of it, to sort of wrap up that whole era of my life.
That's funny. I've, other than 30 Days, there's a Chicago radio station that always calls Barrow on New Year's. I think they have some big, very big New Year's celebration up there.
Probably the one day of the year they get drunk, maybe. Well, you're not allowed to drink too much up there, although they have rules about it because, you know, you go crazy. But, yeah, no, I'll be going up there just to see it for a couple of days.
So is it during the period when it's all daytime or all night, or what's...
They have more of a big twilight period, really.
Okay.
Quasi-day, quasi-night. Yeah, I'll be taking plenty of pictures and blogging about it. So.
Yes, you have a healthy internet presence on Blogger and rather on Twitter.
I do.
And that's cool.
It's minus 40 degrees Fahrenheit. Should be very interesting. I think that's the average temperature. I'm not sure.
Oh, my God.
Something like that. I'd have to look it up.
Jesus.
Yeah, it's going to be cold.
I mean, that's, you know, you get those beautiful shots of, you know, the 10 days of spring or summer that Alaska has, and it really is gorgeous. And then the rest of the time, it's like, oh, my God, how can you live up there? I really, it's amazing. It really is a different world.
Well, global warming will change that. So.
Exactly. Yeah, pretty soon a lot more beachfront property coming to Alaska, I imagine.
Exactly. And there's no tides there, actually, so you don't have to worry about, you know, that stuff.
Crazy.
Yeah, because they're so far up, there's actually no, the moon doesn't affect it so much. So, yeah, it's just like a big lake.
That's insane. It
would be a bit weird for waterfront property, but oh well. But yeah, so expect a lot of pictures online at some point of me in Barrow, Alaska. And possibly of me being murdered if they find out who I am and didn't like the movie.
Oh no, I have a feeling, oh come on, that had to, I would imagine the movie was well received up there, no? And the book.
I have no idea, but when I drew the book, I had literally, like, this was before the age of digital cameras. That's how old I am. there was like three or four Google pictures up of Barrow, Alaska. So that was literally all the reference I had to go on at the time.
Oh, my God.
The damn book back in 2002. So now you can find pictures of it everywhere. So, oh, well. Again, time has screwed me.
Not at all. That's okay. Again, you were able to lean on your more impressionistic views and everything, and we have a more atmospheric book as a result.
Exactly. I was the right artist. Let's go with that answer. Yeah.
I can't imagine anyone else doing that book, man. I mean, your style certainly excited me. And like I say, I had forgotten about Hellspawn, and because 30 Days really stood out. But I know that I was reading Hellspawn as well when you were drawing it. So, yeah, I mean, it was – and following Ash, I think, you know, immediately it seemed – like you say, you tried to conform to Ash's style to begin with. So – It didn't disrupt the feeling that I was getting from Hellspawn, so that was cool.
Oh, yeah, no, I was a huge fan of his, and I still am, so I was definitely trying to keep the whole thing going there. So it would be understandable if people thought I was Ash as well. I did get a lot of that initially as well. But back then, the computer side of things was still pretty new, so anyone who was vaguely computery was still accused of being looking like Ash.
Have you tried some of the new technology? Like, a lot of my friends here in Chicago are using Cintiqs and kind of playing around with those. And
I own one. I think I've used it twice.
Okay.
But I'm actually – the older I get, the more I'm doing, I'm actually going more real world and doing more painting and putting more effort into the actual original art. So I'm going less digital, really, to be honest, which is a bit crazy. But, you know, I do things because they're hard, not because I'm, you know. I don't know. I'm crazy. But yes, Cintiqs look nice. So far, I'm going to figure out how I can use it efficiently but still keep drawing normal. I think they're probably pretty good for painting over existing things or something like that for me.
Can I ask you a couple ugly American questions? And really not, but just...
You can ask me as many questions as you want. This is your show.
Well, you're a good man. I want to ask about Australia. From a comic fan standpoint, what do you guys get down there? Because that's something I haven't had the chance to ask any of the Australian creators I've spoken to.
Okay, well, think of Australia as the entire nation, as in the entire continent. Think of it as sort of a middle-sized U.S. state.
Okay.
For comics. It's as if we were, well, in various ways as well, but... we get our comics from Diamond. They just come a couple of where I was from, they come a couple of days later. In Perth, where I was from, Friday was comic book day because it took that long to get the comics out. And they're all the American comics, generally speaking, just the comics that are in previews. And then we have a small, it was very small when I was there, but very small local industry. But there's no one's really making money on that, only doing comics in Australia or anything, so... You'd have to be linked into I call it the Anglo-American international market. So, yeah, we're really just a small American state when it comes to what comics we read and can buy and get in.
So not much from Europe then?
No,
you know,
definitely in the American sphere of comics.
Okay, so yeah, so big superheroes and stuff and not a lot of, you know, the French-Belgian stuff or the Italian stuff coming through? Or
sadly, no. We're a lot like the UK in that, you know, the UK gets American comics and it's like an English-speaking thing, I guess. But, you know, French comics, I hope, are getting more and more out there, at least with translations, because they're damn beautiful.
They sure are. Absolutely, man. And also, what about, like, the British product? Did that get down there as well?
I grew up with 2000 AD.
Right,
and,
yeah.
A few other comics, but I'm not sure if they came through Diamond, like, literally the American system in the first place anyway. So, but yeah, we definitely got a lot of British comics. So I grew up knowing, you know, all the big... English creators that went on to huge things, a lot of them from 2018, some other English work that they had out before, you know, the American side of things kicked off. So.
Gotcha. And what about things like the Phantom? I understand the Phantom was pretty big down in Australia.
Oh, the Phantom is an aberration, or it was. That's a weird one. It's really popular in Australia, and it was put out, it had like a local distribution deal or something. And I'm not sure if they were reprints or original things, but it wasn't a comic book... normal comic book people, it was like middle-aged businessmen would still pick up the Phantom in these horribly toilet paper, black and white, sort of really old-style comics, even when comics everyone else was kicking off. But
okay.
And it sold like 50,000 copies in the whole country, something like that. It was big for the day. I don't know how it is now, but it was I think it was like older men who grew up with it when they grew up with lots of comics just never stopped buying it. So, It's still had a market. I mean, it's going to have another movie made from it, so someone still likes the Phantom.
And that's what I heard. I heard another film was coming and that it was seeded by Australian money.
Well, fair enough. Yeah, there's actually a pretty damn big fan base for the Phantom, and I have no idea why, but yeah, there was 4 years in Australia.
I like how
they put that money into Mad Max stuff myself, but, you know, more iconic, but, you know, whatever.
I understand. Or even, you know, God, everyone I think was excited when there was that Justice League movie possibly being made in Australia. And then yeah. I guess the laws changed and they decided instead now it's going to actually cost us more money. So, well, never mind.
It's not just the law, it's the sinking of the U.S. peso, actually.
Yeah, exactly.
There's tax stuff, too. But, no, literally, the Australian dollar and the U.S. dollar are nearly the same, which is the reason why I moved back here. So, yeah. It used to be good, not so good now, especially for movie production. So they'll probably stick with, I guess, Canada or other places if they can, like Eastern Europe or something.
Sure.
To keep the cost down. So I know that's Green Lantern was also meant to be filmed, I think, for a period in Australia, but too expensive now. So
crazy.
Currency,
man.
Markets, damn them.
So Choker is how long?
Choker is 22 pages each issue and 6 issues.
6 issues, very cool. And what else?
The storyline is 6 issues. I should say that. But hopefully, if it does well, who knows? There could be another miniseries or two in the future.
Well, it really does look great, and it reads well too. And it is. It's a very cool new detective noir that definitely has a sci-fi twist to it, a horror twist to it as well. And
thank you very much. We tried to put some work into this one.
Well, it looks.
As opposed to my usual work, obviously.
Yeah, better than half-assed Ben Templesmith and Choker. I think everyone's going to be pleased. And honestly, I think people will be very interested comparing this to some of the older books. I think, again, the characters have a bit more of a defined look to them and a different style than some of the more cartoony things that I think I've seen from you in the past. So,
thank you. Yeah. It's still going to have a cartoony feel just because of the nature of the quirk of the book. But, each project should be treated as a individual project. So, yeah, maybe you're just seeing that in it, which is a big compliment to me that someone even noticed. So.
Absolutely, Matt. Is Ben going to be with you at some of the conventions?
He will. He's going to be at the Seattle convention, I know that.
Very cool.
He should be at a Boston one I'm also going to be at. Definitely also the Chicago Con, although I can't really speak for him.
Okay.
In knowing his whereabouts, but we're definitely doing a lot of signings together. In New York, Las Vegas, Arizona, there's the Seattle one, and Orlando as well. So I'm doing about 12 events in the next 2 months, which is going to kill me.
That's terrific. Is there a schedule at your blog?
There will be soon. There's a big poster with listing of the dates and times.
So, okay.
Yes, there is some stuff on my blog and on templesmith.com. If there isn't right now, there will be shortly.
Okay, very cool. And, hey, I'm sorry I missed you. You came in for a couple signings in Chicago in the last few months. Or maybe last year,
I went to Third Coast Comics.
Very cool.
I think it was and I'll actually be launching a new book there just before the C2E2 kicks off.
Oh, that's great. Well, that's what I was going to ask. Beyond Choker, what else is coming up? Is it something you still can't talk about? Or?
Oh, no, I thought it's a thing I'm self-publishing, just printing up myself, literally. A proper printer, by the way, but a nice art book called Squid Girls.
Which is cool.
Ladies and tentacles, but nothing sexual. Putting them together. It's an art book. It's not a comic. It's just my own thing. And, it should be, if all goes well and I get it done in time, launched there.
Fantastic. That's cool. So are they just random sketches of ladies and tentacles, or is it, you know, stuff, bits and pieces from all the years?
Oh, no, it'll be all new dedicated art.
Oh, interesting.
Half of it will be painted as well, so it's going to be a decent book, hopefully, because I have to charge a bit for it, so yeah.
Why ladies and tentacles? What inspired this subject for that kind of sketchbook?
Some people look and ask why. I look instead and ask why not. Why not ladies and tentacles? Come on. I know ladies are popular, and actually, tentacles are popular too.
This is I'm learning this more and more as I've done interviews this month. I've got an interview with Philip from Top Cow. And he was telling me how the Japanese were begging them, Top Cow, to allow the anime of witchcraft to have tentacle sex. and they're like, absolutely not. No, I'm sorry. That's going too far. And a couple weeks later, they came back to him and said, how about just one tentacle? Like, no.
Yeah. Just so you know, not a huge fan of the tentacle porn genre.
All right, we've gone into a weird corner, and I think this is a good place to stop. So,
there's usually a line, and then I cross it.
No, hey, man, it's awesome to talk to you, and I'm looking forward to seeing you at the very least at C2E2. And
definitely.
And we'll look forward to Women in Tentacles and also and also more of Choker, which the proper copies will be coming out in 2 weeks at the end of the month, and that's great. So
yes, they will. So if you see a wrinkled copy now, that's not the way it's actually meant to be, just because I drew it. It's actually a sort of a dud copy. Or a collector's item. Look at it that way.
There you go. And proper copies on their way if you want something more pristine. So that's great. Hey, man, honestly, it's always good to see you at cons, and it's even more of a pleasure to speak to you now. So looking forward to seeing
you at
the next show. And thanks for your time tonight.
Thanks, Tom.
That's artist Ben Templesmith. Make sure you check out Choker, coming from Image Comics. The corrected first issue will be out next Wednesday. In addition to that, Ben will be at C2E2 promoting his latest art book called Squid Girls. And, of course, there's Ben's great backlog of books going from Fell, 30 Days of Night, Groom Lake, of course, his own Wormwood series, and plenty more. Lots of product out there from Ben Templesmith. Make sure you check it out. That'll do it for this edition of Word Balloon. Thanks again for listening. John Sutris reminding you that Word Balloon is brought to you by C2E2, the Chicago Comics Expo, coming to downtown Chicago April 16th through the 18th at McCormick Place. Make sure you check out the details and enter to win free tickets. Go to c2e2.com/wordballoon. Also brought to you by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com, where you'll find great deals on hardbacks, paperbacks, trades, ARCs, you name it. It's all waiting for you at InStockTrades.com. Thanks again for listening. John Sutris reminding you, Word Balloon is all over the internet. Come to our website, wordballoon.com. You'll find our archive of well over 300 interviews with writers and artists. Make sure you subscribe to our feed. Check us out on iTunes. And if you want any questions or comments on the show, several ways to contact me. There is the comments threads at wordballoon.com under each show. Also, our Word Balloon message board, which features discussions about all of our programs. And you can reach me via email, john@wordballoon.com. Follow me on Twitter, John Word Balloon, or check me out on Facebook under my name, John Sutris. Thanks again for listening. Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2010.